Chapter 6. Zerash. Of course we make crutches of one another. Why else would we crawl when we lose our lovers? Antyllus, on the folly of men. History, logic, arithmetic. These all should be taught by slaves. Anonymous, the noble house. Early spring, 4112, year of the Tusk. Zerash. Callus's tactics and the Anathapenian terrain were such that a Commian had few opportunities to appreciate the Holy War's diminished size. Despite the spoils of their victory on the Tyrte Plains, Callus commanded that they forage as they go, forcing the Holy War to disperse across the rugged countryside. From what a Commian could glean from those conversations he cared to overhear, the Faenum in no way resisted their advance. Aside from hiding their daughters and what grain and livestock remained to them, all the villages and towns of eastern Anathapenia capitulated. The men of the Tusk, with their plundered apparel and sun-bitten faces, looked far more Faenum than Enrethi. Aside from their shields and banners, only their weapons and armor distinguished them. Gone were the long war skirts of the Cynrians, the woolen surcoats of the Galeoth, and the waist-bound mantles of the Ainani. Almost without exception, they wore the many-colored calots of their enemy. They rode his sleek horses, they drank his wine from his vessels, they slept in his tents and bedded his daughters. They had been transformed, and in ways that struck far deeper than mere accoutrements. The men a Commian recalled, the Enrethi who'd marched through the southern gates, were but the ancestors of the men he saw now. Just as he could no longer recognize the sorcerer who'd wandered into the Seriotic Library, they could no longer recognize the warriors who'd marched singing into the Carathay Desert. Those other men had become strangers. They might as well have brandished weapons of bronze. The god had called the men of the Tusk. Over battlefield and desert, through famine and pestilence, he had sifted them like sand through his fingers. Only the strongest or the most fortunate survived. The Ainani had a saying, breaking enemies, not bread, made brothers. But being broken, a Commian realized, was more potent still. Something new had arisen from the forge of their collective suffering, something hard and something sharp, something Callus had simply lifted from the anvil. They're his, a Commian would often think, watching their grim ranks file across ridge and hillside. All of them. So much so that if Callus were to die. With rare exceptions, a Commian spent every moment either directly attached to Callus in the sacral retinue or in his vicinity within the canvas warrens of the Umbilica, as the Enrethi had started calling their prophet's stolen pavilion. Until they learned something specific to the contrary, they could only assume that the consult would eventually hazard some kind of assassination attempt. Callus's ascendancy threatened far more than it had already exacted. With the Holy War afield, the opportunities to interrogate the two captive skin spies became sporadic at best. The abominations traveled under Spire's guard with the baggage, each in a covered wain, trussed upright in a network of hanging iron shackles. A Commian now participated in all the interrogations, plying the creatures with those few Gnostic cants of compulsion he knew, to no avail. The various torments Callus devised were likewise ineffective, though for hours afterward, a Commian could scarce blink without glimpsing these sessions. The things convulsing in the fecal darkness, screaming and squealing, their voices fractured into bestial choruses. Then, through throats of gravel and mud, laughing,
Chigra! Woe comes! Chigra!
A Commian couldn't decide what unnerved him more, their many-fingered faces clenching and unclenching, or the hallowed calm with which Callus regarded them. Never, not even in his dreams of the first apocalypse, had he witnessed such extremes of good and evil. Never had he felt more certain. A Commian also attended Callus's every audience with the Scarlet Spires, for the predictable reasons. They struck him as strange, bumbling affairs. Eleazarus, it was obvious, had taken to drink, which had the effect of rendering his manner stiff and awkward. a startling contrast to the loquacious contempt that had so characterized him at Momum. Gone were the despotic self-assurance, the measuring looks, the demonstrations of genanic expertise. Now he seemed little more than a juvenile come to realize the fatal enormity of his boasts. At long last, the holy war marched on Shaima, the stronghold of the Kishorim. There would be no more begging out of battle. Soon the scarlet spires would close with their mortal foe, and their grand master, Hanamanu Eliazarus, was terrified of making mistakes, of burning in Kishorim fire, of destroying his storied school. Against all reason, Akamian actually pitied the man, the way those of hale constitution might pity those of weak in times of sickness. There was no accounting for it. The temper of every man in the holy war had been tested. Some survived stronger. Some survived broken. Some survived bent. And all of them knew who was who and which was which. At no time did the Canv addict, Iacus, attend any of these meetings, nor was he mentioned, small mercies for which Akamian was thankful. As much as he hated the man, as much as he had wanted to kill him that night in the apple garden, he could do no more than exact a fraction of what he was owed. When the 100 pillars had taken the knife to his red irised eyes, Iacus had suddenly seemed a hapless stranger, an innocent. The past became smoke, and retribution an act of abominable conceit. Who was he to pass final judgment? Of all the acts committed by men, only murder was absolute. Had it not been for Zynemus, Akamian doubted he would have done anything at all. The practical concerns of the march monopolized Kellis's days. A continuous train of Enrethi caste nobles conferred with him, bearing intelligence of the lands ahead, disputes that required resolution, and more, once the Holy War crossed the frontier into Zarash, council on matters of war. Akamian typically found himself floating in and out of the various parties that formed about Kellis. Sometimes, out of curiosity, he would pay heed to the issues discussed. Since he often remained while others arrived and departed, he was able to witness, time and again, the prodigious depths of Kellis's intellect. He would listen to him recite, word for word, messages and admonitions that had been delivered days previously. There was not a man whose name he failed to recollect, not a detail that he missed, even when it came to mundane matters of supply. Akamian lost count of the times he turned to others, particularly Kellis's seneschal secretary, Gaia Macri, in disbelief. They would grin and shake their heads, their brows pinned high in joy and awe. Their astonishment became their confirmation. "What have we done?" the man once said to him, "to deserve such wonder." Aside from discussions involving great names, Akamian soon lost interest in these small dramas. His thoughts would wander much as they had before, when he'd marched with the livestock and baggage. The arriving caste nobles would still acknowledge him, but he would quickly fade into the fluid backdrop that constituted the sacral retinue. In spite of his lack of interest, the absurd gravity of his charge was not lost upon Akamian. Sometimes, during moments of boredom, an odd sense of detachment would overcome him as he watched Kellis. The surreal glamour would fall away, and the warrior prophet would seem as frail as the warlike men about him, and far more lonely. Akamian would go rigid with terror, understanding that Kellis, no matter how godlike he seemed, was in fact mortal. He was a man. Was this not the lesson of the circumfiction? And if something were to happen, nothing would matter. Not even his love for Esmanet. A strange zeal would creep through his limbs then, one utterly unlike the nightmare-born fervor of Mandate schoolmen, a fanaticism of person. To be devoted to a cause alone was to possess momentum without direction or destination. For so long, wandering had been his twilight mission, beaten forward by his dreams, leading his mule down road and track, and never, not once, arriving. But with Kellis, all this had changed. This was what he could not explain to Nozera, that Kellis was the incarnation of the abstractions that gave their school purpose. In this one man lay the future of all mankind. He was their only bulwark against the end of ends, the No-God. Several times now, Akamian thought he had glimpsed golden halos about Kellis's hands. He found himself envying those such as Proyas, who claimed to see them all the time, and he realized that he would gladly die for Anassarimber Kellis. He would begrudge no sacrifice, despite his unrequited hate. To his dismay, however, Akamian found it increasingly difficult to sustain these feelings across the seasons of the day. His thoughts began wandering, so much so that he sometimes doubted his ability to protect Kellis should the consult attack. He would shake his head, eye the distances with a hawkish scowl. He would try to scrutinize every petitioner who approached Kellis. As always, Esmanette remained his greatest distraction. Some day she rode, and though uncertain at first, she'd swiftly learned both beast and saddle. Even attached to Kellis's immediate entourage at the fore of the sacral retinue, Akamian saw her regularly. Sometimes he would wax melancholy, silent while Kellis and his caste noble commanders droned in the background. Sometimes he would simply wonder at the mere sight of her, at her acts of mannish boldness, at the way she wielded unquestioned authority over those in her train. Everything about her would seem brisk and decisive. She would seem a stranger. Usually, however, Esmanette traveled in what others began to call the Black Palanquin, a luxurious litter borne on the backs of some 16 Kianine slaves. A scribe would ride with her, and throughout the day, Akamian saw men on horseback come to confer with her on inscrutable matters. He saw her physically only when Kellis rode alongside the palanquin, bearing questions or instructions. Through intervening limbs and torsos, he would glimpse her painted lips beneath the curve of bundled shears, or her forearm across a raised knee, her fingers hanging from a relaxed wrist. The urge to crane his neck, or even to call out her name, often struck him with a force of pain. He almost never saw her eyes. Most of their encounters occurred after the march, in the moat of activity that encircled the umbilica. As these meetings were public, she typically afforded him little more than a courteous nod. Akamian had thought her cruel at first, suspecting that she, like so many, nursed grudges to better cultivate hate. What better way to eradicate the remains of their love? But after a time, he realized she behaved this way for his sake, as much as for hers. Everyone knew they'd been lovers before Kellis had taken her. Though no one dared mention it, he saw it in their looks from time to time, especially with Proyas. A sudden consciousness of another's shame, a sudden pity. Any warmth she showed him would simply remind others of his humiliation, his disgrace as a cuckold. 5 days out of Karaskand, after the slaves had hoisted and furnished the great pavilion, Akamian withdrew to his chambers so he might change into his evening attire, and there she was, standing in the canvas gloom waiting for him, dressed in a paneled robe of gold and black, her hair bound in a Girgashi headdress. "Akamian," she said, "not Akka." He struggled with his composure, beat down the desire to sweep her into his arms. To his dismay, she spoke only on matters regarding the security of Kellis's person. He half expected her to cite the articles of his service as though she were an empress and he a foreign consul on indenture. Akamian found himself playing along, answering her questions concisely, astonished at the absurdity of their new circumstance, impressed by the rigor and insight of her interrogation, and proud, so very proud of her. "You've always been my better." Where others were simply walls to him, Esmanette was an ancient city, a maze of little streets and squares where once he had made his home. He knew her hospices and her barracks, her towers and her cisterns. No matter where he wandered, he always knew that this direction led here and that direction there. He was never lost, though outside her gates all the world might confound him. He knew the habit of lovers, their inclination to make scripture out of self-deception. There was little difference, he had often thought, between the devotional verse of Protathus and the graffiti that marred the bathhouse walls. Love was never so simple as the marks with which it was written. Why else would the terror of loss come upon lovers so often? Why else would so many insist on calling love pure or simple? What he and Esmonette had shared had been inexplicable, as was what she shared with Kellis now. A Commian would often overlook the innumerable horrors she had endured, the death of her daughter, Maimara, the hungry seasons, the anger in all the faces grimacing over her, the bruises, the danger. With the exception of Maimara, she would speak of these things with dismissive humor, something that a Commian, for his part, had encouraged. How could he bear her burdens when he could scarce bear his own? The honesty would come later, in the way she squeezed his fingers, or in the momentary terror that flickered through her gaze. He knew this, and yet he said nothing. He shrank from the work of understanding. He put his trust in the inexplicable. I failed her, he realized. Small wonder she'd failed him in turn. Small wonder she had succumbed to Kellis. Kellis. These were the most selfish and therefore the most painful thoughts. Esmonette had loved joking about cocks. She marveled at the way men fussed over them, cursing, congratulating, beseeching, coaxing, commanding, even threatening them. Once, she told a Commian about a deranged priest who had actually held a knife to his member, hissing, "You must listen!" After that, she said, she understood that men, far more than women, were other to themselves. He had asked her about the temple prostitutes of Gira, who believed that despite the hundreds of men who used them, they coupled with only one, Hotos, the Priapic god. She laughed, saying, "No deity could be so inconsistent." A Commian had been horrified. Women were windows through which men could peer into other men. They were the unguarded gate, the point of contact for deeper, more defenseless selves. And there had been times, a Commian could now admit, when he feared the raucous crowd that scrutinized him through her almost guileless eyes. All that had consoled him was the fact that he was the last to bed her, would always be the last. And now she was with Kellis. Why was this thought so unbearable? Why did it cramp his heart so? Some nights he would lie awake and remind himself over and over of just who it was that Esmonette had chosen. Kellis was the warrior prophet. Before long, he would demand sacrifices of all men. He would demand lives, not just lovers. And if he took, then he gave as well. Such gifts. A Commian had lost Esmonette, but he had gained his soul, had he not? Had he not? Other nights, a Commian would toss to and fro, silently howl with jealousy, knowing that she gasped and bucked upon him, that he used her in ways a Commian never could. Her climax would ring higher, her limbs would tingle longer, and afterward she would make jokes about sorcerers and their stubby little cocks. What was she thinking, rolling with a fat old fool like Drusus a Commian? But most of the time, he simply lay still in the darkness, smelling the extinguished candles and censers, longing for her as he'd never longed for anyone or anything. If only he could hold her, he would tell himself, recounting recent glimpses of her the way the greed-stricken might count coins. If only he could hold her one last time, she would see, would she not? She had to see. Please, Esme. One night, lying exhausted after the Holy War's first march into the Zarashi Plains, a Commian was struck numb by thoughts of her unborn child. He ceased breathing, understanding that this, more than anything else, was the measure of the difference between her love for him and her love for Kellis. She had never surrendered her horror shell for a Commian. She had never even mentioned the possibility of children. But then, he realized with a tear-blinking smile, neither had he. With this recognition, something either broke or mended within him, he could not tell which. The following morning, he sat at one of the slave fires, watching two nameless girls tear up stalks of mint for tea. For a time, he stared in a blinking stupor, still awakening. Then he looked past them, where he saw Esmonette, standing in the near distance with two Nascenti in the shadow of dark horses. She caught his eyes, and this time, rather than nod without expression or simply look away, she smiled a shy and dazzling smile. And somehow, he just knew. Her gates had been closed. She was a direction his heart could no longer go. Memories of that other fire. They came to Akamian as an affliction now. Esmanet leaning against him in laughter, Serwe clapping her hands in delight, her face beaming innocence, Zynemus with his eyes, Kellis saying, I was scared.
You were scared of a horse?
The thing was drunk, and it was looking at me. You know, the way Zin looks at his mare.
What?
Like something to be ridden. How they had loved teasing Kellis. What joy they'd found in his feigned frailties, and that was the least of what they had lost. That other fire, so different from this one, with its silk and awkward misery, now they reclined with ghosts. Akamian had come to Proyas's pavilion out of boredom more than anything else. He could tell from the Kianine body slave's reaction that all was not right with his presence, but he'd been drinking, and he felt belligerent. The idea of annoying another struck him as justice. The gold-chased streamers were drawn aside. He saw Proyas, dressed in a robe more appropriate to convalescence than to entertaining, sitting before a small iron-grilled firepot. Zynemus sat to his left, and a woman sat across from him. Esmanet.
Akka?
Proyas said with a nervous and telling glance at the consort. His face was drawn. After a moment's hesitation, he said, Come in. Please, join us.
I apologize. I'd hoped to find you alone.
He said come in!
Zynemus barked with that antagonistic good nature only inveterate drunks could master. He had his profile turned to the air as though he aimed his left ear.
Yes, Esme said.
Her voice sounded forced, but her eyes looked sincere. It was only as Akamian drew up a reluctant pillow that he realized she'd spoken more out of pity for Zynemus than out of any real desire for his company. He was such a fool. She, on the other hand, looked a breathtaking beauty. It almost galled him to glance at her, not only because all men secretly rank the relative beauties of women they've lost, but because she had been but a lovely weed when she was with him, and now she seemed an astonishing flower. Pearls on silver strings, hair like shining jet fixed high on her head with two silver pins, a gown with a shimmering print, dark and troubled eyes. The body slave busied himself collecting spent bowls and plates. Both Proyas and Esmanet paid the man extravagant attention. Everyone seemed stricken, with the exception of Zynemus, who gnawed meat from sawed ribs. Pork stewed in some kind of sweet bean sauce. It smelled delicious.
How are the lessons? Proyas asked, as though just recalling his manners.
Lessons? Akamian repeated.
Yes, with...
He shrugged, as if unsure of their old ways of referring.
With Kellis.
Simply speaking the name had become something like twisting a tourniquet. Akamian brushed at his knees, even though he could see nothing that blemished them.
Good.
He did his best to sound light-hearted.
If I somehow live to write a book about these days, I'll call it On the Varieties of Awe.
You stole my title!
Zynemus exclaimed, reaching out to fumble for some more wine. Proyas quickly intervened, pouring a deep bowl for him, smiling despite the brittle exasperation in his eyes.
Why?
Esmanet asked. Akamian winced at the sharpness of her tone. Blind as he was, Zynemus saw slight everywhere. He had become worse than the Skilvendi.
What's your title, Zin?
Zynemus slurped some wine, then in his classic deadpan muttered,
On the Varieties of Ass!
They howled with laughter. Akamian looked from face to beaming face, pressing away tears with his thumb. Memories flooded him. For a moment, it seemed that Esme need only reach out and clasp his hand, press the pad of her thumb against the nail of his own, and everything would be undone. Everything that had happened since Shygek. All of them are here, all the people I love.
My sense of smell!
Zynemus protested.
I'm telling you, my sense of smell reaches farther than my eyes ever did. Into the deepest of cracks. You, Proyas, you think you ate mutton last night.
He looked to empty spaces, grimacing.
But it was really goat.
Esmanette rolled back on her cushions, chortling, kicking her small feet. Zynima swung his head toward the sound of her laughter. He wagged a knowing finger, which he then brought to his nose.
There's beauty, so much beauty in what we see, he said with mock eloquence. But there's truth in what we smell.
Their laughter became brittle then, suddenly keen to a dangerous shift in his manner. In a moment, it trailed away altogether.
Truth! Zynemus cried with savagery. The world stinks of it!
He made as though to stand up, but rolled back onto his rump instead.
I can smell all of you,
he said as if in answer to their shocked silence.
I can smell that Akka's afraid. I can smell that Proyas grieves. I can smell that Esme wants to fuck.
Enough, Akkamian cried.
What's this madness? Zin, who's this fool you've become?
The marshal laughed, possessed of a sudden, improbable lucidity.
I'm the same man you knew, Akka.
He shrugged in a drunk's exaggerated manner, holding his palms out.
Just minus my eyes.
Akkamian fairly gaped. How had it come to this?
Zin, my world.
Zynemus drawled on, smirking in a lurid approximation of good humor,
has been shorn in half. Before, I lived with men. Now I dwell with asses.
No one laughed. Akkamian found himself standing, thanking Proyas for his hospitality. The Khonryan prince sat as one broken, silent as the grave. Despite his fluster, Akkamian understood that the prince had made Zynemus his punishment. By overturning all the old reasons, Kellis had rewritten the regrets of many, many men. Zynemus coughed, and Akkamian saw Esmanette start at the sound. More than foul humors ailed the marshal. He seemed worse every time Akkamian saw him.
Yes, Zynemus said. By all means, flee, Akka.
His sneer seemed hale despite his pallor.
I'll return with you, Esmanette said to Akkamian, who could only nod and swallow. What's happened to us?
Be sure to ask her,
Zynemus growled as they hurried to the threshold.
Why, she's fucking callous!
Sin! Proyas cried, more in terror than anger. His thoughts buzzing, his face burning, Akkamian turned to his former study. But in his periphery, he could see that Esmanette had turned to him, blinking tears.
Esme.
What?
Zynemus laughed with mock good humor.
Is the blind man the only one who can see? Do the ancient tropes so rule us?
Whatever it is you suffer, Proyas said evenly, I will endure its course. I've sworn this to you, Zin, but I'll tolerate no blasphemy. Do you understand?
Ah, yes, Proyas the judge.
The marshal leaned back into his drink and cushions. When he continued, it was with a strange, dislocated voice, one that had discarded hope.
So he bade Horomon, he quoted, to offer his cheeks into his hands, saying to the others, this man who has put out the eyes of his enemy, the goddess struck blind. Then he spit once into each socket and said, this man who has sinned, I have made clean. And Horomon cried out in wonder, for he had been sightless, and now he could see.
He quoted the tractate, Akkamian realized, the famed passage where Inri Sejanus restored the sight of a notorious Arashi criminal. For many Inrithi, seeing with Horomon's eyes was synonymous with revelation. Zynemus turned from Proyas to Akkamian, as though from a lesser to a greater enemy.
He cannot heal, Akka, the warrior prophet. He cannot heal.
Akkamian had hoped the air outside Proyas's pavilion would be free of the cramped smells and madnesses of the air within. It was not.
The sky was clear, though not as sharp as the arid nights of Shigek. A haze of smoke, bitter with the scent of wet wood, washed across the deserted clearing, as did a scattered chorus of nearby voices, Conryans drinking about their fires. He looked to Esmanette, grinning as though in relief, but she was staring at the shadows. In a tent somewhere nearby, someone was muttering with the concentrated rage of a drunk.
"He cannot heal, Akka."
Neither of them uttered a word as they walked side by side through the dark lanes. The various tents and pavilions loomed out of the darkness. The fires glared. His left hand tingled with memories of holding her right. He cursed himself for the longing that filled him. How could he walk in the midst of so much dread wonder and yet feel only the tug of her? The world clamored, encircled him with a thousand dire claims, and yet he could listen only to her silence. "I walk," he reminded himself, "in the shadow of the apocalypse." "Zin," Esmanette abruptly said. She spoke hesitantly, as though after a long and inconclusive reverie. "What's happened to him?" Akamian's heart leapt so violently he found himself dumbstruck. He had resolved himself to silence. To walk with her alone in the dark was torment enough, but to speak? He looked to his sandaled feet. "You think the question's stupid?" Esmanette snapped. "You think—" "No, Esme." There had been too much honesty in the way he spoke her name. Too much pain. You've no idea what Kellis has shown me," she said. "I, too, was Horomon, and now, the world that I see, Akka, the world that I see, the woman you knew, the woman you loved, you must know, that woman was—" He couldn't bear these words, so he interrupted. Zin lost more than his eyes in Iothea. 4 silent steps in the dark. "What do you mean?" "The cants of compulsion. They... His voice trailed. "If I'm to be master of spies, I need to know these things, Akka." Esmanette was right. She did need to know these things. But she pressed the issue, Akamian knew, for far different reasons. The estranged always resorted to talk of third parties. It was the most convenient course between insincere pleasantries and dangerous truths. "The cants of compulsion," Akamian continued, "are misnamed. They're not, as many seem to think, torments of the soul, as though our soul were some kind of miniature thing, something vulnerable to sorcerous instruments the way the body is to physical. The compulsions are different. Our soul is different." She studied his profile, but looked away when he dared glance at her. "Souls compelled," he continued. "Are souls possessed?" "What are you saying?" Akamian cleared his throat. She had spoken as one accustomed to cutting through the verbal dross of underlings. "They used him against me, Esme. The Scarlet Spires." He blinked, saw the 100 Pillars guardsmen gouge out Iacus's eyes. "They used him against me." They had passed near a crowded bonfire. He could see her face in the intermittent firelight. Her look narrowed, but in the careful way of those skeptical of someone they pity. "She thinks me weak." He stopped, glared at her impossibly grand aspect. "You think I fish for sympathy? Then what's your point?" He beat down the anger that welled through him. "The great paradox of the compulsions is that their victims in no way feel compelled. Zin sincerely meant everything he said to me. He chose to say them, even though others spoke the words." Whenever Akamian had explained this in the past, the questions and challenges had been immediate. How could such a thing be possible? How could men take compulsion for choice? Esmanette asked only, "What did he say?" He shook his head, graced her with a false smile. "The Scarlet Spires, trust me, they know which words wield the sharpest edges. Like Kellis." There was compassion in her eyes now. He looked away. "Akka, what did he say?" Figures passed to and fro before the bonfire, and shadows swept the ground between them. When he matched her gaze, it seemed he was falling. He said, a pause. He cleared his throat. He said that pity was the only love I could hope for. He saw her swallow, blink. Oh, Akka. Of all the world, only she truly understood. Of all the world. Longing crashed about the pilings of his resolution, to crush her in his arms, to press her back tenderly, then kiss the faint saddle of freckles across her nose. He resumed walking instead, found peevish relief in the way she obediently followed. He said things, Akamian continued, coughing against a voice-cracking ache. He said things without hope of forgiveness. Now he can't bring himself to stop. Esmanette seemed baffled, but that was months back. Blinking, Akamian looked to the sky, saw the round of horns glittering in an arc over the northern hills. It was an ancient Kunayoric constellation, unknown to the astrologers of the three seas. Think of the soul as a network of innumerable rivers. With the cants of compulsion, the old banks are swamped, dikes are washed away, new channels are cut. Sometimes when the floodwaters recede, things resume their old course. Sometimes they don't. Four silent steps in the dark. When she replied, there was genuine horror in her voice. Are you saying? Her brow slackened in incredulous astonishment. Are you saying the Zin we knew is dead? The thought had never occurred to Akamian, as obvious as it was. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what I'm saying. He turned to her, reached out to clasp her forbidden hand. She didn't resist. He tried to say something, but his jaw could only jerk back and down, as though something different, something deeper than his lungs, demanded breath. He pulled her against him, amazed that she remained so light. Then the old habits seized them, locked them together like hands. She bent to him as she had a thousand times. He fell into her lips, her smell. He wrapped himself around her trembling frame. They kissed. Then she was fighting him, striking him about the face and shoulders. He released her, overcome by rage and ardor and horror. No, she sputtered, beating the air as though fending off the mere idea of him. I dream of murdering him, Akamian cried. Murdering Kellis! I dream that all the world burns and I rejoice, Esme. I rejoice! All the world burns and I exult for love of you! Her eyes were wide and uncomprehending. Every part of him beseeched her. Do you love me? Esme, I need to know! Akka, do you love me? He knows me. He knows me like no other. And suddenly he understood. It seemed so clear. All this time, mourning, thinking he had nothing to offer, nothing to lay at the foot of her altar. That's it! Don't you see? That's the difference! This is madness, she cried. Enough, Akka, enough! This cannot be! Please, listen. You must listen. He knows everyone, Esme, everyone. She was the only one. How could she not see? Like a kicked scroll, the logic of it rolled through him. Love required ignorance. Like any candle, it needed darkness to burn bright, to illuminate. He knows everyone! His lips were still wet with the taste of her, bitter, like tears across cosmetics. Yes, Esmanette said, retreating step after step. And he loves me. Akamian looked down to gather his wits, his breath. He knew she would be gone when he looked up. But somehow he had forgotten the others, the Enrithi, who had walked and caroused about them. More than a dozen of them stood like sentinels in the firelight, staring at him, their faces blank. Akamian thought of how easily he could destroy them, blast the flesh from their bones. And he matched their astonished scrutiny with this knowledge in his eyes. To a man, they looked away. That night, he beat the matted earth in fury. He cursed himself for a fool until dawn. The arguments were assembled and were defeated. The reasons railed and railed. But love had no logic, no more than sleep. When next he saw her, he could find no trace of this encounter, save perhaps for a certain blankness in her expression. It was mad, the moment they had shared, as she had said, and for days afterward, Akamian half expected the 100 pillars to bring charges against him. For the first time he realized the dimensions of his plight, that he had lost her not simply to another man, but to a nation. There would be no outbursts of jealous rage, no confrontations, only cloaked officials in the night, discharging their writ without passion. Just as when he'd been a spy. He wasn't surprised when no one came, just as he wasn't surprised when Kellis said nothing, even though he most certainly knew. The warrior prophet needed him too much. That was the bitter explanation. The other was that he understood, that he too mourned the contested ground between them. How could one love one's oppressor? Akamian didn't know, but he loved nonetheless. He loved them both. Every evening, following a typically lavish meal with the Nesenti, Akamian would wend his way through the hanging corridors of the Umbilica to a leather chamber in the lesser wing, what the Nesenti had come to call, for no reason Akamian could fathom, the scribal room. At the entrance, a lantern-bearing guard would always lower his face and murmur either Vizier or Holy Tutor in greeting. Once within, Akamian would spend time rearranging the rugs and cushions so that he and Kellis could sit comfortably face to face instead of peering about the pole in the room's center. Twice he'd upbraided the slaves, but they never learned. Then he would wait, staring across the woven pastoral set, as was the fashion for the Kianine, in a geometric maze of panels. He wrestled with the inevitable demons. Protecting Kellis had been the charge of his school. As real as it was, the prospect of a consult attack seemed to concern Kellis little. Akamian often worried that Kellis merely tolerated him out of courtesy, as a way to build trust with a formidable ally. Teaching Kellis the Gnosis, however, was an altogether different matter. This was the warrior prophet's own charge. Even before their first lesson together, Akamian had known these exchanges would be things of wonder and terror. From the very first, even as far back as Momim, there had been something remarkable about Kellis's company. Even then, he'd been someone whom others sought to please, as if they grasped without knowing what it meant to stand tall in his eyes. The disarming charisma, the endearing candor, the breathtaking intellect. Men opened themselves to him because he lacked all those deficiencies that led brother to injure brother. His humility was invariable, utterly disconnected from the presence of other men. Where others crowed or fawned, depending upon whose company they kept, Kellis remained absolute. He never boasted, he never flattered, he simply described. Such men were addicting, especially for those who feared what others saw. Long ago, Akamian and Esmanet had made a game of sorts out of their attempts to understand Kellis, particularly after they had acknowledged his divinity. Together, they had watched him grow. They had watched him struggle with truths that everyone else had secretly accepted. They had watched him set aside his immaculate humility, his desire to be less than he was, and take up his calamitous destiny. He was the warrior prophet, the voice and vessel, sent to save men from the second apocalypse. And yet somehow he remained Kellis, the Lackland prince of Atrathau. He commanded obedience, certainly, but he never presumed, no more than he had about Zynemus's fire. And how could he, when presumption measured the gap between what was demanded and what was justified? Kellis had never exacted anything beyond his due. It just so happened all the world fell within the circle of his authority. Sometimes Akamian found himself joking with him in the old way, as though the revelations of Karaskand had never happened, as though Esmanet had never happened. Then something, a glimpse of a circumfix embroidered on a sleeve, a whiff of feminine perfume, would strike him, and Kellis would be transformed before his eyes. an unbearable intensity would shine from his aspect, as though he were a kind of lodestone made flesh, drawing things unseen yet palpable into his orbit. Silences seethed, words thundered. It was as though every passing moment resonated with the unvoiced intonations of 1,000,000 priests. Sometimes Akamian gripped his knees against the sensation of vertigo. Sometimes he blinked against the glimpse of halos about his hands. To sit in his presence was overwhelming enough, but to teach him the Gnosis? To limit Kellis's vulnerability to Kore, they had agreed they should start with everything, linguistic and metaphysical, short of actual cants. As with the exoterics, instruction in the esoterics required prior skills, arcane analogs to reading and writing. In At Yersus, teachers always started with what were called denotaries, small precursor cants meant to gradually develop the intellectual flexibility of their students to the prodigious point where they could both comprehend and express arcane semantics. Denotaries, however, bruised students with the stain of sorcery as surely as any cant, which meant that in some respects, Akamian had to start backward. He began by teaching him Gilkunya, the arcane tongue of the Nanmen Kuya, and the language of all the Gnostic cants. This took less than 2 weeks. To say that Akamian was astonished or even appalled would be to name a confluence of passions that could not be named. He himself had required 3 years to master the grammar, let alone the vocabulary, of that exotic and alien tongue. By the time the Holy War marched from the Anathpanean hills into Zerash, Akamian started discussing the philosophical underpinnings of Gnostic semantics, what were called the Eturi Sohonka, or the Sohonk Theses. There was no bypassing the metaphysics of the Gnosis, though they were as incomplete and inconclusive as any philosophy. Without some understanding of them, the cants were little more than soul-numbing recitations. Whether Gnostic or anagogic, sorcery depended on meanings, and meanings depended on systematic comprehension. Think, Akamian explained, of how the same words can mean different things to different people, or even different things to the same people in different circumstances. He racked his memory for an example, but all he could recall was the one his own teacher, Simus, had used so many years ago. When a man says love, for instance, the word means entirely different things depending not only on who listens, be it his son, his whore, his wife, the god, but on who he is as well. The love spoken by a heartbroken priest shares little with the love spoken by an illiterate adolescent. The former is tempered by loss, learning, and a lifetime of experience, while the latter knows only lust and ardor. He could not help but wonder in passing what love had come to mean for him. As always, he dispelled such thoughts of her, by throwing himself into his discourse. Preserving and expressing the pure modalities of meaning, he continued, this is the heart of all sorcery, Kellis. With each word, you must strike the perfect semantic pitch, the note that will drown out the chorus of reality. Kellis held him with his unwavering gaze as poised and motionless as an Nilnameshi idol. Which is why, he said, you use an ancient non-man tongue as your lingua arcana. Akamian nodded, no longer surprised by his student's preternatural insight. Vulgar languages, especially when native, stand too close to the press of life. Their meanings are too easily warped by our insights and experiences. The sheer otherness of Gilkunya serves to insulate the semantics of sorcery from the inconstancies of our lives. The anagogic schools, he tried to smooth the contempt from his tone, use haikuna, a debased form of Gilkunya, for the same reason. To speak as the gods do, Kellis said, far from the concerns of men. Following a fleet survey of the theses, Akamian moved on to the persimiata, the meaning-fixing meditative techniques that mandate schoolmen, thanks to the Seswathan homunculus within them, largely ignored. Then he delved into the technical depths of the semansis dualis, the very doorstep of what had been, until the coming of the man who sat before him, a final precursor to damnation. He explained the all-important relation between the two halves of every cant, the inutterals, which always remained unspoken, and the utterals, which always were spoken. Since any single meaning could be skewed by the vagaries of circumstance, cants required a second, simultaneous meaning, which, though as vulnerable to distortion as the first, braced it nonetheless, even as it too was braced. As Uthrata, the great Kunayoric metaphysician, had put it, language required two wings to fly.
So the inutterals serve to fix the utterals, Kellis said, the way the words of one man might secure the words of another.
Precisely, Akamian replied. One must think and say two different things at once. This is the greatest challenge, even more so than the mnemonics, the thing that requires the most practice to master. Kellis nodded, utterly unconcerned.
And this is why the anagogic schools have never been able to steal the gnosis, why simply reciting what they hear is useless.
There's the metaphysics to consider as well, but yes, in all sorcery, the inutterals are key.
Kellis nodded. Has anyone experimented with further inutteral strings?
Akamian swallowed.
What do you mean?
By some coincidence, two of the hanging lanterns guttered at the same time, drawing Akamian's eyes upward. They instantly resumed their soundless illumination.
Has anyone devised cants consisting of two inutteral strings?
The third phrase was a thing of myth and Gnostic sorcery, a story handed down to men during the non-man tutelage, the legend of Sutjuroit, the great Kunaroi witch-king. But for some reason, Akamian found himself loath to relate the tale.
No, he lied. It's impossible.
From this point, a strange breathlessness characterized their lessons, an unsettling sense that the banality of what Akamian said belied unthinkable repercussions. Years ago, he had participated in a mandate-sanctioned assassination of a suspected Anani spy in Kunraya. All Akamian had done was hand a folded oak leaf containing belladonna to a scullery slave. The action had been so simple, so innocuous. Three men and one woman had died. As always with Kellis, Akamian needed only to gloss the various topics, and then only once. Within the course of single evenings, Kellis mastered arguments, explanations, and details that had taken Akamian years to internalize. His questions always struck to the heart. His observations never failed to chill with their rigor and penetration. Then at last, as the first elements of the Holy War invested Garotha, they came to the precipice. Kellis beamed with gratitude and good humor. He stroked his flaxen beard in an uncharacteristic gesture of excitement, and for an instant resembled no one so much as Inrau. His eyes reflected three points of light, one for each of the lanterns suspended above Akamian.
So the time has finally come.
Akamian nodded, knowing his apprehension was plain to see.
We should start with some basic ward, he said awkwardly. Something you can use to defend yourself.
No, Kellis replied. Begin with a cant of calling.
Akamian frowned, but he knew better than to counsel or contradict. Breathing deeply, he opened his mouth to recite the first utteral string of the Ishra Discursia, the most ancient and most simple of the Gnostic cants of calling. But for some reason, no sound escaped his lips. It seemed he should be speaking, but something inflexible had seized his throat. He shook his head and laughed, glancing away in embarrassment, then tried once again. Still nothing. Akamian looked to Kellis, more than baffled.
I cannot speak.
Kellis watched him carefully, peering first at his face, then apparently at an empty point in the air between them.
Seswatha, he said after a moment.
How else could the mandate have safeguarded the gnosis for so many years, even with the nightmares? An unaccountable relief washed through Akamian.
It must be.
He looked to Kellis helplessly. Despite all his turmoil, he truly wanted to yield the gnosis. Somehow it had become oppressive in the manner of shameful acts, and for whatever reason, all secrets clamored for light in Kellis's presence.
He shook his head, lowered his face into his hands, saw Zynima screaming, his face clenched about the knife point in his eye.
I must speak with him, Kella said.
Akamian gaped at the man, incredulous.
With Seswatha? I don't understand.
Kellis reached to his belt and drew one of his daggers, the Umarnan one, with a black pearl handle and a long, thin blade, like those Akamian's father had used for deboning fish. For a panicked instant, Akamian thought that Kellis meant to debone him, to cut Seswatha from his skin, perhaps the way physician priests sometimes cut living infants from dying mothers. Instead, he merely twirled the pommel across the table of his palm, holding it balanced so that the Selokaran steel flashed in the light of their firepot.
Watch the play of light, he said. Watch only the light.
With a shrug, Akamian gazed at the weapon, found himself captivated by the multiple ghosts that formed about the spinning blade's axis. He had the sense of watching silver through dancing water. Then, what followed defeated description. There was a peculiar impression of elongation, as though his eyes had been drawn across open space into airy corners. He could remember his head falling back, and the sense that, even though he still owned his bones, his muscles belonged to someone else, so that it seemed he was restrained by the force of another in a manner more profound than chains or even inhumation. He could remember speaking, but could recollect nothing of what he said. It was as though his memory of the exchange had been affixed to the edges of his periphery, where it remained no matter how quickly he snapped his head, always just on the threshold of the perceptible. Unknown permissions. He began to ask Kellis what had happened, but the man silenced him with a closed-eye grin, the one he typically used to effortlessly dismiss what seemed to be crucial questions. Kellis told him to try repeating the first phrase. With something akin to awe, Akamian found the first words tumbling from his lips, the first utteral string.
Iratis renies lo okoi menien loroi hapara,
followed by the corresponding inutteral string.
Li jinieriera qui ashiritien hejaroit.
For a moment, Akamian felt disoriented. Such was the ease of reciting these strings apart. How thin his voice felt. He gathered his wits in the ensuing silence, watching Kellis with something between hope and horror. The air itself seemed numb. It had taken Akamian 7 months to master the simultaneous inner and outer expressions of the utteral and the inutteral strings, and even then, he'd started with the remedial semantic constructions of the denotaries. But somehow, with Kellis. Silence. So absolute, it seemed he could hear the lanterns wheeze their white light. Then, with a faint, otherworldly smile upon his lips, Kellis nodded, looked directly into his eyes, and repeated,
Irates renies lo okoi menien loroi hapara,
but in a way that rumbled like trailing thunder. For the first time, Akamian saw Kellis's eyes glow, like coals beneath the bellows. Terror clawed the breath from his lungs, the blood from his limbs. If a fool such as him could bring down ramparts of stone with such words, what could this man do? What were his limits? He remembered his argument with Esmanet and Shygek long ago, before the library of the Sariots. What did it mean for a prophet to sing in the god's own voice? Would that make him a shaman, as in the days described in the Tusk? Or would it make him a god?
Yes, Kellis murmured,
and he uttered the words again, words that spoke from the marrow of existence, that resonated at the pitch of souls. His eyes flashed like gold afire, ground and air hummed. And at last Akamian realized,
I have not the concepts to comprehend him.